Hello and welcome to Foresight with me, Greg Williams. Today we're going to talk about quantum computing, a technology that can feel challenging to get a grip on, both conceptually and in terms of its practical applications. We're told that over the coming decades, quantum computers could transform medicine, break encryption and revolutionise communications and artificial intelligence. And we know that every large tech company and many startups are in a race to build reliable quantum computers and scale them into working machines. We also know that China has invested billions in quantum, and that some people argue that this is a technology where there is no silver medal, that the gap between whoever wins and second place will be vast. Even the most bullish quantum enthusiasts acknowledge that quantum maturity will take many years, but we are beginning to see the emergence of an ecosystem of startups specializing in materials, software, the internet, and hardware across a spectrum of research, prototype, and product. So I'm keen to understand what the implications of all this are, the potential applications from drug discovery to the geopolitical impact, and how the field will develop over the coming years, and whether it really holds as much promise as we're led to believe. So the question we're addressing today is, to some degree, a fairly straightforward one. What is quantum computing, and what does it mean for all of us? To answer that question, I'm delighted to welcome Jeremy O'Brien to the podcast. Jeremy is the CEO of PsiQuantum, a startup based in California that claims to be building the world's first useful quantum computer. Formerly a professor of physics and electrical engineering at Stanford and director of the Center for Quantum Photonics at the University of Bristol, Jeremy has announced that PsiQuantum will have built a quantum computer with 1 million qubits, the minimum number deemed necessary for a commercial system, within a handful of years. And intriguingly, the company is taking a different approach to many others in the field by focusing on photonics, the science of light waves, which it claims has significant technical advantages over other approaches. He'll explain more about this during our conversation. Before we get into this, I should note that as part of the Wired and Penguin Random House book series, my colleague Amit Katwala has written an excellent guide to quantum computing. I'd really highly recommend it if you're looking for a thorough, detailed, but readable beginner's guide to the world of quantum. There's a link to it in the program notes. Now on to the conversation with Jeremy from PsiQuantum.
Well, Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us. So I'd really like to start with an apology. It's a high-level question, but I think it would really help for everyone listening to just to get a real sense of, like, from your perspective, how quantum computing really differs from classical computing, and why should everyone listening be so excited about it?
Yeah, that is indeed the question to ask as far as I'm concerned. And I think to understand the difference between quantum computing and any other technology is firstly to appreciate that it's got almost nothing to do with computing. I think quantum computing really suffers from having that word computing in the title. And although, yes, it is a type of computer, yes, it is a faster computer, it's exponentially faster. And that means it takes problems that are otherwise forever impossible and makes them possible. And so sometimes I like to use the analogy that, you know, quantum computing is to conventional computing what a warp drive that enables intergalactic travel is to conventional transport. Sure, you could lump it in and say, yep, they're all just modes of transport. But if I've got a warp drive that enables me to travel to distant galaxies, probably think of that as something completely different from a, you know, aeroplane or a bus or a bicycle.
Sure. Okay. So it's effectively, it's just something that massively changes the way that we think about computing. But again, you said you think that the word computing in there is maybe not helpful to people understanding how different this is.
Yeah, I mean, it categorically is a computer and it computes, and there are a lot of parallels with conventional computing. But I think the reason, and I'm sort of half joking when I say it suffers from having the word computing in it, but I'm also half serious. And the serious part is that I think if you have that word quantum computing, you tend to sort of think, okay, this is just a super fast computer or the next generation of computing or the next big thing in computing or something. And it really isn't that. It's something entirely different in that it's really taking these problems of huge importance across pretty much every aspect of human endeavor that are otherwise forever going to remain impossible. So even if, you know, Moore's law marched on for centuries into the future and we turned the entire planet into a giant supercomputer, we still wouldn't be able to solve large instances of exponentially hard problems, some of which we understand how to solve on a quantum computer.
So there are so many, well, not so many, but there are very different approaches to quantum computing. Maybe kind of like the next step in this conversation is if you can give us just an overview of what these different approaches are.
Yeah, that's also, I think, a really interesting distinction between conventional computing. Of course, if you go far enough back in history, there were also different sort of many different physical instantiations of conventional computing. And right now, quantum computing is in that sort of phase where there are many different ways that people are pursuing to make a quantum computer. And essentially, any system that you can get some level of control over and exhibits quantum mechanical behavior is a potential candidate. And so people are looking at everything from, superconducting circuits, atomic systems, ion traps, semiconductor quantum dots, and so the list goes on. And the approach that we're developing at PsiQuantum is one where we encode, rather than in those matter-based approaches where, at their heart, those systems are encoding in electrons, just as we do in a conventional computer at its most fundamental level. It's an encoding in the flow of electrons. What we do is we encode in photons, so single particles of light. And indeed, that is also the encoding that we use for telecommunications in today's communication systems.
And what's the advantage of that approach in particular, Jeremy?
Yeah, well, that is really where I ended up at I've been in quantum computing for about 25 years, and I've, had my hands on, many different matter-based approaches, gallium arsenide, quantum dots. I've made, superconducting devices, phosphorus donor spin qubits in silicon, et cetera, et cetera. And, NV centers in diamond and so on. And the whole way through that journey, what I was searching for is a path whereby we could leverage the semiconductor industry and the 50 years of development that went into that and the $1 trillion of investment and repurpose that to deliver a quantum computer. Because it has been my conviction for those, the better part of those 25 years that until we figure out how to do that, until we figure out how to leverage the semiconductor industry, we won't have quantum computing in my lifetime. And this photonic approach that we are developing, I believe, is unique in being able to leverage that, and that's why we're pursuing it.
So there are kind of lots of different players, obviously, in this space. We have Google and Microsoft and IBM, these very large organizations. Numbers of startups, of course, academics. Can you just give us a sense of the landscape, if you don't mind, please?
Yeah, you're right. I think there are. There's a large number of research groups around the world. So it's funny, I feel like an old man, and that's probably because I am. When I first learned about quantum computing back in the mid 90s, I then went on a sort of hunt to, do a PhD in the topic, and that was next to impossible. And now I think it's probably the case that many physics departments in particular, but also electrical engineering, computer science, mathematics departments around the world are dominated, maybe not dominated, but there's certainly large activities in research. I think it would not be unusual to find a physics department where maybe, let's say, a third of the graduate students or a quarter of the graduate students were working on quantum computing, quantum technologies and associated activities. And so it's grown globally to become a very big activity indeed in academia. And as you highlight, the large corporations, particularly tech corporations, but are pursuing their own sort of hardware approaches. And then other corporations are also have, automotive manufacturers to financial organizations have their own internal teams who more often than not are not developing the hardware, but are figuring out exactly how to do it. So they have PhDs in quantum computing, figuring out how they're going to use this technology for their businesses.
And would it be fair to say, just that characterization, you know, 25 years in quantum, is that shift now to, you know, maybe 30% of, you know, departments, physics departments, having people working on quantum in them, is that attributable to the fact that it's may be moved from being theoretical to clearly kind of practical? And that's the kind of like the direction of travel.
Yeah, I think that is a fair, you know, a fair assessment that there's been a sort of steady march towards, you know, a real, you know, technology and product. And indeed, you know, these ideas started as, you know, fairly nebulous, you know, sort of, well, it sounds like it could be possible, you know, firming up theoretically. I think for me, one of the big breakthroughs was, you know, the fault tolerance threshold that tells you that you can correct for errors and therefore make a useful quantum computer. That was really a big, you know, other than the original idea of, you know, a quantum computer and, you know, it's so on. This is the sort of theoretical step that means that it's in principle practical. And then following that, there were sort of many, you know, works and efforts to think about, well, how would we actually instantiate such a device? You know, what sorts of systems would we have under control that would enable us to do that? And that led to what we started this conversation with this sort of, you know, spectrum of different, you know, approaches, which, you know, span almost all of, you know, experimental quantum physics, not quite particle physics, but, you know, or cosmology, but indeed some of the tools from those areas of experimental physics are deployed. But, you know, atomic and molecular physics, semiconductor physics, and so it goes, are all, you know, included in the mix. And then, you know, that there's been a steady march from people, you know, for example, in 1999, people demonstrated NEC, in fact, in Japan, with a superconducting circuit, demonstrated, you know, coherent oscillations of that circuit. So the real sort of evidence of a qubit, single qubit behavior. And then, you know, some years later, a two-qubit gate. And so, you know, so that march went on. But, you know, for me personally, it was always about, okay, you know, we've got to do that. We've got to figure out, you know, what are the qubits, what are the gates and so on. But let's look to what's really required to deliver a useful technology. And the answer has always been, well, you need about 1 million qubits plus to do that. That means you need a very large scale system. What are the challenges to scaling? And those challenges are, in fact, you know, largely have nothing to do with quantum physics or qubits or anything like that. They're system engineering type challenges.
Right. And I think that it would be great now if you could just kind of talk a little bit about the hardware side of this. We've seen these amazing images of these, you know, quantum computers. Can you talk a little bit about that kind of that physical side of the work that's being done in order to move this field forward?
Yeah, so as we were discussing earlier, lots of different types of, you know, physical instantiation. So you see lots of images of, you know, superconducting circuits sitting at the bottom of dilution refrigerators, cooling them to tens of millikelvin. That's a very popular type of approach. Ion traps, where you take, you know, single atoms, you ionize them by removing an electron so that they're charged, and then you trap those charged ions using electromagnetic fields and address them with lasers and or with, microwave electromagnetic fields, semiconductor quantum dots in all sorts of different semiconductor materials where, again, you're typically cooling them to millikelvin temperatures. There you're often addressing them with microwave pulses, any sort of single quantum system where you have some levers to be able to control it presents an opportunity for a qubit, and then, you know, you need to be able to get interactions between them and so on. So there's actually a lot of different types of, you know, physics laboratory type of kit represented across all of those different approaches. And the one that we're working on, which I can tell you about in detail, is that silicon photonics one. So encoding in single particles of light, those single particles of light, single photons, they propagate through waveguides on a silicon chip. Those waveguides are very much like optical fibers that are etched into a silicon into a silicon chip. And then, you know, if you have a pair of waveguides, then, you know, which of the two waveguides the photon is in encodes the zero and the one. It's a pretty simple idea, but it's one that has really profound implications in terms of that manufacturability, as well as these larger scaling issues that I'd be happy to talk about in a bit of detail as well.
That's great. Yeah, I'd love to get into that. And I guess sort of, you know, in terms of the genesis of this, we're sort of seeing, you know, increases in the number of qubits. You're attempting to build a quantum computer with a million qubits. Can you just talk a little bit about that challenge and how you're how you think about it and how you're proceeding?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right.
I mean, it's a huge task, right? I mean, it is
indeed. Yeah, and I've, as I say, I've been on a 25-year mission to do that, and together with my three co-founders, when we uncovered a path to that million qubit regime, that's when we founded this company. And I guess the four of us had spent, you know, a combined 60 years in university research in, you know, physics and electrical engineering departments. The last decade or so in the UK, in fact, all four of us, and we were on a mission to figure out a path whereby we could deliver a million qubit system, because, you know, we, like many others, you know, we understood that, yeah, really the promised land of quantum computing is in that million qubit error corrected regime. And you know, we had done, in fact, some of the early work on boson sampling, a kind of implementation of quantum supremacy. We had, you know, co-invented the variational quantum eigensolver with our colleagues at Harvard and implemented that on a chip. So we'd done a lot of this work in that sort of small noisy system regime, had an exploration of that, and really concluded that, yeah, it's got to be a million qubits. And I think that what's interesting is it's, you know, as I look back on that 25 years, that's really been the status quo for the whole time. Yeah, you really need a million qubits. And then over the last 5 or 6 years, there's been, you know, a lot of, you know, I would say unwarranted, actually, enthusiasm for these sort of small noisy systems with, you know, 100 to 1,000 qubits, and the sort of hope that maybe we can find something useful to do there. So far, no one has found anything useful to do there. And indeed, you know, I was at an event at the White House a few weeks ago with sort of representation of, you know, all of the major quantum computing efforts in the US, which indeed represents, you know, certainly a majority of the major quantum computing efforts in the world indeed. And now it's really clear, a vast majority of people are saying exactly that, you know, to do anything useful in a quantum computer requires a million plus qubits. There's still a couple of people holding out hope for, you know, a small noisy application. So far, they don't exist, and you know, it's looking, you know, increasingly unhopeful on that front. So yes, we founded a company exclusively targeted on that million plus qubit regime because that was our understanding. And I think if you went back 5 or 6 years and you held that same event, we would have been probably the lone, or at least a lonely voice in the room saying that you needed a million qubits. So we're very glad that we did indeed set out on that, you know, that grandest of challenges to a million qubit regime, because that really is what's required for all of these useful applications. And of course, you know, that's a very different kind of regime from, you know, whether you have 20, 50, 100 qubits is probably not so relevant if you need a million qubits. It's, you know, the analogy is sort of, well, you know, if you're going to get to the moon, you're going to need to build a rocket engine and a rocket fuselage and, you know, a control system and all that sort of thing. And, you know, building a taller and taller, you know, ladder is, okay, it's getting you closer to the moon, but it's ultimately not going to get you there. And I think that's the sort of top-down, bottom-up sort of approach, you know, incrementing up in numbers of qubits, I don't think is necessarily a way to get you into that regime. And that's why, as I said at the start, it's really for us, and I believe any delivery of a million qubit machine requires leveraging that semiconductor industry. So figuring out how to sort of repurpose that extraordinary manufacturing capability for delivering a quantum computer. So let me pause there because I've been going on for quite a bit and see if I'm still making sense. No,
there's just a lot to unpack. It's great. A couple of questions that immediately kind of come to mind. One is you talked about your work on and I want to come back to the qubits straight after this, but just for to help listeners out, because there is still sort of so much kind of there's so many terms in quantum that I think are worth having explained by someone like yourself. You talked about your work in quantum supremacy. Can you just explain what quantum supremacy means and how it's achieved, please?
Absolutely. So quantum supremacy is just a really dumb name, coined by a very brilliant colleague of mine, John Preskill at Caltech, and I think probably he and the field probably regret the terminology. But the important point is that is a demonstration of a quantum system that cannot be simulated on a conventional computer. And so the first report of that was by Google in 2019 with a 53 qubit system, so a thumbnail sized system of 53 superconducting qubits did something that couldn't be done on the world's fastest supercomputer, which is a multi warehouse, you know, multi aircraft hangar sized, you know, mega compute system. And you can appreciate just what a important landmark that is from a scientific perspective. And I think part of the challenge for you know, maybe for your listeners and people out there in the world who aren't in the field of quantum computing, which is the majority of the world's population, is that you might naturally think that, okay, we're there, you know, we have quantum computing and you know, all this wonderful stuff follows. But it turns out that no one has found anything useful to do in that regime of, you know, quantum supremacy. And the other kind of term that gets thrown around is NISQ, NISQ, noisy intermediate scale quantum, and that's just a sort of catch-all for that, you know, 100 to 1,000 qubit regime where, you know, you don't implement error correction. So you've got qubits, and you can implement a small sort of set of gates on them before that noise comes to sort of swamp the signal. And that's the sort of where there has been over the last 5 or 6 years a lot of hope that someone could find something useful to do in that regime. And so far they haven't. So that's quantum supremacy and NISQ. And then, you know, quantum computing in the sort of large scale error corrected regime is where you have of order a million plus qubits from which you distill around 100, maybe several hundred logical error corrected and therefore, you know, guaranteed to be useful qubits. And that's the regime that we have been focused on exclusively. And it's also the regime where I would say, you know, it's just unequivocal. Like, there is huge value in that regime. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of a map of the landscape there.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you. And I guess, you know, you mentioned that, was it the 53 qubits for quantum supremacy, the Google computer? I feel like there's constant announcements in this space. Just last night when I was thinking about talking to you, I kind of saw the IBM announcement about its 127-qubit quantum computer, which is apparently double the size of comparable machines made by Google and by the University of Science and Technology in China. So I'd love to sort of, from the perspective of where you're trying to get to with a million qubits, where are we in the genesis of this technology? Are we in the foothills still, or are we beyond that now, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think we're in the regime where it's, you know, it's unequivocal that you know, quantum computers at scale, so at that million qubit scale, will be truly world-changing technologies. I would even contend, and I'm far from alone in this, I think large-scale error-corrected quantum computing in that million-plus qubit regime will be the most profoundly world-changing technology that humans have uncovered to date. And I'd love to talk to you about, you know, exactly what you know, what changes might be wrought by that technology. And as you say, we're in the sort of 100 qubit regime at the moment globally, and you know, give or take, you know, various different organizations, you know, making announcements about various different numbers and so on. But essentially, we're in that sort of 100 qubit regime. And clearly, that's well short of the million qubit regime that you need to be in for those useful applications. And so the way I would sort of characterize it is that the qubit problem is solved. You know, like, everyone can make qubits. My grandma can make qubits. I'm of course completely joking, but the point is that, you know, back when I started out, you know, that's when people were sort of starting to make qubits and, you know, then do one qubit gates and two qubit gates. Now it's, you know, in all of the sort of leading platforms, you know, you can make qubits, you can make gates, you can make small scale systems with, you know, maybe a dozen, maybe a few dozen qubits, and run small scale sort of proof of principle algorithms that give you, you know, real confidence that you've got a handle on how things work and all the rest of it. And I think the only question that really needs to be answered is, how do you get to that million qubit regime? And, you know, how far away is that? You know, like, what's the time frame from getting there? And as far as the hardware goes, but then I think, you know, the average person wants to know, and what will that mean? Like, what changes will be wrought on the world? Because, you know, if you look at the analogy, you know, you and I are both holding mobile phones in our hand, and, you know, there's plenty of people, you know, using those devices who don't understand how one of the many billions of transistors in those things work, because it's not really important to understand how they work. What's important is, what are the implications for my life and for the world?
Right. Well, let's dig into that. I mean, what do you think the kind of the primary implications are going to be?
Well, I think that, you know, quantum computing promises to have a, you know, huge impact across pretty much every, you know, aspect of, you know, human endeavor, every existing industry. Indeed, you know, we're working with customers across, you know, the aerospace, automotive, finance, pharmaceutical, you name it, industries. And, you know, these organizations increasingly have their own team of quantum computing people. They increasingly have a really sophisticated understanding of, you know, how they're going to use this technology to transform their business and their industry. And one of the areas that, you know, I'm particularly focused on is sustainability and climate change. And the reason for that is that, well, it's probably the most urgent challenge that we face. And it's one where, you know, one of the sort of foundational things that a quantum computer will be able to do is unlock our ability to do chemistry. And that's underpinning of many applications in climate change, as well as, you know, materials, chemicals, pharmaceutical industry, and so on. You know, at some sort of hierarchical, you know, abstract level, everything ultimately requires a chemical explanation. Whether that thing
and,
is...
And every biological thing
absolutely requires a chemical. Absolutely. Right, yeah. Everything that pre-exists in the world, whether that's, you know, out there in the environment, in my body, you know, every biomolecule and so on, everything that we might hope to engineer and so on. And, you know, we humans, I believe, we fall into this sort of trap of thinking that we live in a really advanced technological age, which of course is a natural thing to do, unless you're, you know, a post-Roman Empire, you know, middle age, you know, looking at, you know, Roman roads and Roman ruins or something. It's a very natural thing to do, because you can look at the, you know, Computer History Museum or the Museum of, you know, Medicine and think, wow, you know, like, you really cut people's skulls open with, you know, carpentry saws and drills and so on. And I believe that if we're going to, you know, sort of sustain ourselves, never mind thrive at the sort of population levels that we're at now, we're going to need to look back on today and look at our current best technology and think, oh, isn't that cute? You know, like, we've got this phone with its chassis and its dedicated little battery thing and so on. And I think that's, you know, true across many, many things that we do. And the reason that quantum computing is going to have such a profound impact here is because it totally transforms the way we can interact with the, you know, the existing physical world and the physical world that we're, you know, creating and manipulating around us, because it opens up the ability to simulate that chemistry. At the moment, what we're doing with chemistry is we're sort of just doing an ad hoc, you know, trial and error type of flying blind, you know, hope and see what happens type of approach. My sort of provocation that I, you know, I'm happy to give to professors of chemistry, and they're usually very happy to acknowledge it, is that we can't, in fact, even really do chemistry until we've got a quantum computer. And it sounds a bit outrageous because, you know, we've been doing chemistry in, you know, a modern way for a century plus, but it is true in the sense that if you can't simulate the building blocks of the natural world that you find around you, or the building blocks of the systems that, that you know, you're engineering yourself, that's pretty tough. That's a pretty funny business. It's like trying to build a, you know, a state-of-the-art supersonic aircraft without the aid of a conventional computer. And the sort of cartoon in my head is, you know, guys in a blacksmith's workshop hammering and tonging, and out pops an F-35. That's what we're trying to do with chemistry in, you know, in the pharmaceutical industry is a good, great example where, you know, they have the resources. You know, if they could solve this problem, they would have solved this problem, but it happens to be, you know, impossible to solve without a quantum computer being able to simulate those, you know, the molecules that serve as pharmaceuticals, as well as the molecules that they interact with, as well as that hierarchy of, you know, biochemistry and biology and so on. So that's a little bit of a rambling flavor of one sort of domain of really important underpinnings. And as I say, that sustainability part of things is one where I think there's huge potential from, you know, designing more efficient batteries, solar cells, a catalyst that you could cheaply and easily mass produce to, you know, suck gigatons of carbon out of the atmosphere, turn it into something useful like a fuel or a plastic or a material or something, essentially to get sort of mastery over the physical world at that fundamental, you know, molecular scale. And you know, we urgently need to do that with, I would say, you know, climate change, healthcare, energy. So the list goes on.
Yeah, I think that the maybe one of the misunderstandings about quantum is that it's just going to be, it just means that we're going to basically be accelerating the things that we're doing already. So, for instance, you know, we're using AI for drug discovery. What you're describing is something far more fundamental than that. That's you're describing something where we understand the physical and chemical world in entirely new ways that we probably can't even imagine right now, right?
You're exactly right. Yeah, you're exactly right. It's really not just, you know, more and better and faster and so on. It's just a complete shift of things that are otherwise impossible and turning them into becoming possible. You're absolutely right. It's a complete transformation, and some of those things we can imagine. So, for example, you know, the analogies are, well, just as we, you know, at some point in designing modern aircraft, we, you know, we stopped using wind tunnels with scale models and replaced that with, you know, a bank of supercomputers running MATLAB simulations of those yeah. systems. In the future, we'll stop sort of randomly mixing compounds together with robot arms in some dark lab somewhere, in the hope that we might chance upon some new compound that we could deploy for a pharmaceutical. That's the industry that, you know, has the resources to do it. But of course, we want those new materials not just for, you know, healthcare, but for all aspects of our lives. And it's turning that sort of you know, real. You know, the way I sort of think about it is the way we're doing things today is sort of like flailing around in the dark with a blindfold on, constrained to this cave that is just a tiny subset of this entire possibility. You know, we've got this Lego set, right? The periodic table of elements that we can put together in an infinity of ways, right? Like for all sorts of purposes. Nature, by the way, of course, has taken a different approach called evolution, and over billions of years, it's learned how to perform miracles with chemistry, including life, right? Including, you know, you and me in this conversation that we're having. So we know that extraordinary things are possible with chemistry, right? That's the sort of proof positive thing here. And I could give you a really specific example that might be interesting on that front if you're interested. And
yes, please do. Yeah.
Yeah. It's this example of nitrogen based fertilizer. So you may have come across this, and some of your listeners may have too, but I really like it because it really speaks to, you know, the constraints that we're under without quantum computing and sort of speaks to what could become possible with quantum computing. So, you know, the story goes that depending on how organic your diet is, the up to 50% of the nitrogen in your body, of which there's a lot, nitrogen is the fourth most abundant element in your body, after carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And it's very abundant, right? Like the air is, 70, 80% nitrogen. So there's plenty of it around. It's a very, very strongly bonded molecule. It's very, it's effectively an inert N2 molecule because it's so strongly bonded. And so you can't breathe nitrogen into your body and access it that way. You get it through the food that you eat. And the food that you eat gets it in modern agriculture through ammonia fertilizer. So it gets nitrogen through ammonia fertilizer, and we couldn't feed probably half the world's population without that ammonia-based fertilizer. And we figured out how to make that fertilizer in a so-called Haber-Bosch process that was invented around 1910. Today, that production of ammonia, which is, ammonia, of course, is a feedstock for, cleaning products, pharmaceuticals, all sorts of things, but it's predominantly used for fertilizer. And production of ammonia consumes a few percent of the world's energy production and a few percent of the world's natural gas production. And we use the natural gas to get hydrogen. So it's, natural gas is pretty volatile and you can get the hydrogen out of it. And then you use the energy to create high temperature, high pressure reaction vessels, which enable you to break apart that nitrogen bond and turn, nitrogen in nitrogen N2 molecules and hydrogen from natural gas and turn it into NH3 ammonia. And the energy is used for the high temp, for maintaining that high temperature and the high pressure. So there's a really good economic reason why you'd want to do better than that, because it's consuming a lot of energy and a lot of natural gas. And of course, water also contains plenty of hydrogen in it, but again, it's very strongly bonded molecule, a water molecule, and getting the hydrogen out of it requires a lot of energy. But we haven't done better over more than a century, despite that economic imperative, an increasingly environmental imperative for doing better. And we haven't done better despite knowing for sure that there is a better way of doing it, because there are bacteria in the soil that are doing that same thing at ambient conditions, not at high temperature, not at high pressure. And that's nature's solution to the problem, right? Is over billions of years, nature has evolved, enzymes in those bacteria that can take nitrogen from the atmosphere, hydrogen from water in the environment, and in a sort of symbiotic relationship with plants, provide that fertilization. So we know it's possible, and yet we can't solve the problem. And so I really like that example, because we think we're doing really sophisticated things in chemistry. You think you're doing something sophisticated? Have you had a look at what the natural world is doing in chemistry? It's doing things that actually blow your mind, not that should blow your mind. They actually blow our minds when we stop to think about it. And that's just one very concrete example. But of course, the whole human body, the whole natural world is a chemical process extraordinaire, right? And if you can't, we're never going to be, we don't understand how that, how that bacteria does that chemistry, right? Like we kind of have an inkling, we kind of know which part of the nitrogenase enzyme does that work, but we can't understand it, and we'll never be able to simulate it on any conventional computer. And that's just one very specific example. And I like it, as I say, because it's sort of at the intersection of agriculture and energy, molecular simulation. It's very concrete. We should have it. We do indeed have a. I met someone the other day who did a PhD long ago on trying to come up with a better catalyst for that process. Yeah, I think it's a pretty interesting one, but I want to emphasize that it's just one of a multitude of such examples. And just quickly, that CO2 catalyst is an analogous type of thing, a catalyst that could take CO2 out of the atmosphere and turn it into something useful. It's the same sort of chemistry that would underpin that, the same sort of catalyst that you would want to do that.
So we're right up against time, Jeremy, but I'd love to just ask you one final question, which is just look forward out to the next, 10 years in quantum. Like, what do you think it's going to look like in terms of its development? What are your hopes?
Well, I'm really convinced that, by the end of this decade, we will have developed, that sort of large scale error corrected system and be already seeing the impact in these most important domains across, sustainability, energy, healthcare. And I think that's only possible as a result of this, focus on that million qubits and the fact that we're able to leverage the semiconductor industry to bring that about. That puts us on a very short time frame. And if we hadn't uncovered that path, I would still be a professor of physics and electrical engineering, happily sitting there wondering how on earth could we build a million qubit quantum computer. And then, as of whatever it is, 5-6 years ago, we figured that out, and now we're on a course to doing that, and that's super exciting, as you could imagine.
Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us here at Foresight. It's been so great talking to you, because the passion and the excitement of your work really comes through. So thank you so much, and everyone's going to be looking forward to hearing what comes next in quantum now. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Real pleasure to chat to you.
From PRX.